morning. My name is Michael McCusker. Tomorrow, May 17th, is the 65th anniversary of the 1954 unanimous Supreme Court decision under Chief Justice Earl Warren to integrate public schools in the United States, Brown versus Board of Education. The Supreme Court concluded that, quote, in the field of public education, the doctrine of separate but equal has no place. Separate educational facilities are inherently unequal and are deprived of the equal protection of the law guaranteed by the 14th Amendment. Racial integration and civil rights for blacks and other so-called minorities have not been easily accepted by white Americans, whose ancestry is primarily albino European. And under the current virulently racist presidency of Donald Trump, right-wing bigots are as determined to rescind school integration as they are to abolish the Supreme Court ruling that legalizes abortion, Roe versus Wade. David A. Horowitz, Portland State University history professor emeritus, he has been a PSU prof for 50 years, wrote about grassroots white attitudes towards integration and civil rights in his book, Beyond Left and Right, Insurgent Challenges to the Established Order of 20th Century America, which is the basis of today's program, subtitled from his book, A Nation in Riot. Much of David's research was conducted in Texas, where he had access to the papers of Lyndon Baines Johnson. A Nation in Riot, Grassroots Response to Civil Rights, 1954 to 1965, by David A. Horowitz. The most important internal historical event in the past 10 years, White House aide George F. Reedy wrote to President Lyndon B. Johnson in 1965, has been the change in race relations in the United States. It was during this period that the federal government used unprecedented power and influence to strive for equal opportunity for the nation's racial minorities. These efforts, however, brought forth bitter response from those Americans who believed they had reason to distrust the power of the federal government and who objected particularly to government intrusion in the area of human relations. This was particularly so in the South. The critical response to the Civil Rights Revolution embodied social and political attitudes radically diverse from a consensus that placed great faith in bureaucratic structures and managerial methods of conflict resolution. It often seemed to emanate from those Americans who felt increasingly powerless before a national political structure which operated through the mechanisms of administrative bureaucracy. These grassroots Americans also suspected that the national corporate culture was devoid of meaningful values or spiritual underpinning. The attempts by the federal government to harness business corporations, labor unions, civic groups, and the media to resolution of the civil rights issue revealed an explosive chasm between estrangement and the inability of managerial culture to successfully address that alienation. Relations between blacks, whites, and the federal government were unalterably redefined by the U.S. Supreme Court's school integration decision of 1954 and by President Dwight D. Eisenhower's decision to dispatch federal paratroopers to assure the racial integration of Central High School in Little Rock, Arkansas during 1957. The Eisenhower administration also took steps to enact civil rights legislation between 1956 and 1960. During this period, mail poured into the office of Senate Majority Leader Lyndon B. Johnson of Texas. Johnson played a key role in packaging two civil rights bills between 1957 and 1960, which placed moderate amounts of federal power behind voting rights for Southern blacks. Many of the senator's Texas constituents and other Americans, however, reacted caustically to the civil rights advances of the late 1950s. Much of the criticism focused on the Supreme Court and the power of the federal government itself. Forced school integration, a New Mexico correspondent complained in 1957, was, quote, further evidence of totalitarian socialism in Washington. A lumber mill executive wrote in an East Texas daily newspaper that the Supreme Court had committed juridical usurpation. The only supreme law of the land, he argued in an extended essay, is the will of the people. The Supreme Court's school integration decision had interfered with what civil rights critics saw as two essential prerogatives, the right of free association and local control over public education. Our religious institutions and our school institutions are instruments through which we train and improve our population for better living, a San Antonian wrote to the governor of Texas in 1957. Schools and churches were to be supported, quote, by the free choosing of the people supporting such facilities, the writer wrote, claiming that by compelling racial integration in the public schools, the Supreme Court had substituted the rational code of legal fiat for original and time-worn standards of human relations, quote, unquote. Of course, we people in Texas like the Negroes and treat them right, a Waco physician wrote to Johnson in 1957, but we do not want to sleep or eat with them. School integration was but a first step toward forced equality of association, the doctor wrote. An old acquaintance of Senator Johnson's pleaded not to, quote, turn our state's customs and social conditions over to the Negroes. Whites had made the country, he argued, and it was their decision to make regarding schools and other public functions, quote, unquote. Others simply argued that social status was to be earned and equality of association to be mutually agreed upon by the parties concerned. Neither could be enforced by court order, federal law, or bayonet. Critics of government intervention in civil rights believe that emotion, not reason, was the final determination in all human actions. Consequently, any governmental attempt to employ force and compulsion in these matters amounted to tyranny. Invasion of private rights of association and the growing power of the federal government to compel an ordering of race relations contributed to the widespread notion that the ruling bureaucracy and courts were communist. Communism in this context signified a centralized administrative state that used coercive methods to intervene in areas of social and personal relations that customarily were left in private hands. For this reason, one of Senator Johnson's correspondents offhandedly could refer to Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, Earl Warren, as that social communist. A widely broadcast radio message of Mississippi Senator James O. Eastland, syndicated in 1959 by the conservative Mannion Forum, bore the title, The Supreme Court, a Revolutionary Tribunal. Civil rights critics saw a connection between centralized government and communism, particularly in the power of such government to intrude in fundamental rights. Civil rights will do more in destroying basic American rights and liberties than any other current threat, a correspondent from Dallas warned Senator Johnson early in 1960. Personally, I fear our own liberties worse than I do the Russians, he wrote. Congressman John Dowdy of East Texas warned his constituents that administrative powers in the federal government were similar to the absolutism of the monarchies of other days, and that an all-powerful central government was a necessary element before communism or other forms of dictatorship could gain control of the people. A letter writer from San Antonio simply referred to Russian-dictated civil rights laws. Government-enforced racial integration of public schools and accommodations also brought out the fear that human distinctions would be erased through miscegenation and the emergence of one race. To some civil rights critics, racial differences were as important to preserving the distinctive features of human personality and culture as were the differences between ethnic and national groups. The communists and one-worlders and the advocates of one race are fighting true white Americans from all sides, a Dallas woman complained to Senator Johnson in 1960. To a correspondent from Lubbock, Texas, Eisenhower and the nine men of the Supreme Court had commenced to create a dictatorship in a, quote, one-world system. Why can't separate states or communities maintain control of race relations? An exasperated resident of Lockhart, Texas, asked her senator. Because we have more communists sneaked in our government, she answered. Negroes were an inferior race easily led by an inferior communist, the woman wrote. The obliteration of racial distinctions seemed to convey a vision of mass depersonalization to those Americans frightened by the Civil Rights Revolution. The loss of personal and cultural identity, in turn, was inextricably connected in the minds of these critics with the political tyranny of bureaucratic communism and government intervention in local and private affairs. It was in this spirit that a Waco, Texas woman pleaded with Lyndon Johnson to serve grassroots Americans by restoring constitutional government. We need you with all your zeal behind the America we once knew, she concluded. The presence of federal troops in Little Rock during 1957, however, confirmed the worst fears of those who objected to government intrusion in race relations. A theater owner in Wascom, Texas, warned Senator Johnson that school integration would spell the doom of our beloved little towns. The troops had been called into Little Rock, another Johnson correspondent proclaimed, to cram integration down our throats by further disgracing the people of the South. When the House of Representatives passed civil rights legislation during the summer of 1957, the outcry from the South was vehement. Introduced the previous year, the bill proposed to send federal investigators to states in which racial discrimination was practiced in regards to school enrollment, access to public accommodation, and voting rights. The bill empowered the Attorney General of the United States to institute civil action to correct instances of racial discrimination. Contempt charges arising out of these proceedings were not to be tried by a jury. Once the bill passed the House, the attack on its provisions was led by Senator Richard Russell of Georgia. Comparing the proposals to the force bills of the post-Civil War Reconstruction era, Russell warned his colleagues that the unusual powers of this bill could be utilized to force the white people of the South at the point of a federal bayonet to conform to almost every conceivable edict directed at the destruction of any of the local customs, laws, or practices separating the races in order to enforce a commingling of the races throughout the social order of the South. And that was Russell. Although President Eisenhower told Senate Majority Leader Johnson that the proposed legislation was the mildest civil rights bill possible, Russell's perceptions were shared by many of those who wrote the Texas senator. The civil rights bill is the most vicious thing since the Civil War, a Motley County judge announced. The civil rights bill stinks, a woman from Tyler complained, and we Americans are sick and tired of being forced into the gradual mixing of our white race with that of the Negro. An accountant from Dallas saw in the litigatory sections of the bill nothing but an instrument to take the guts out of Americans into a people harassing each other. A woman wrote that Negroes only wanted to get control of white people. The 1957 Civil Rights Bill struck at the heart of freedom of association that many Americans believed to be a constitutional right, accused a number of letter writers, including one to Senator Homer B. Capehart of Indiana. The writer, an Indiana native, was concerned about the future in a nation that was forcing the mixture of races, quote unquote. Once the Civil Rights Bill came to the Senate, Johnson succeeded in winning passage of a compromise version. Under his influence, the Senate struck out the school integration and public accommodations sections and confined the Attorney General's civil suits to the area of voting rights. Even so, opposition remained adamant. A Johnson staff tally of 475 selected letters during the summer of 1957 indicated that less than 10% of the correspondents approved the final package. The bill was a sly foot in the door to totalitarianism, a Mississippi man criticized. A letter to the Dallas News, forwarded to Johnson's office, described the Civil Rights Commission created by the legislation as a Gestapo to pry into our everyday lives, carrying with it the right of ancient inquisitions. From the Young Democrats of San Angelo, Texas, came a stark warning that the boys at the barber shop will not long stand for a federal dictatorship. The passage of a second civil rights bill in 1960 furthered political pressures on the South. Following a six-day Southern filibuster in the Senate, Majority Leader Johnson succeeded in bringing forth a bill that authorized federal district judges to appoint referees to enroll qualified blacks in areas where local authorities systematically denied voting rights. The bill also extended the life of the Civil Rights Commission. Once again, mail to Johnson's Senate office was extremely negative. The Civil Rights Commission, a Houston THD complained, were quasi-judicial bodies investigating charges brought by citizens against other citizens. A Houston woman stated an often repeated theme. "You are bound and determined," she wrote angrily, "to give all the benefits to the Negroes at the expense of the whites." While Congress debated the 1960 Civil Rights Bill, black college students organized massive sit-ins at segregated lunch counters throughout the South's major cities. The following year, activists coordinated a series of freedom rides across the region to push forward the integration of interstate bus transportation. President John F. Kennedy sent 600 federal marshals and FBI personnel to observe. During 1962, Kennedy federalized the Mississippi National Guard and sent federal troops and marshals to ensure the integration of that state's university. Although the administration avoided direct conflict with state authorities and was reluctant to intervene at all, the introduction of a federal police presence incensed many loyal Southerners. "Please remove U.S. Marshals out of Alabama immediately," a Houston telegram advised Vice President Johnson in 1961. "Please quit aiding troublemaking Negroes at taxpayers' expense." A Dallas physician complained that the massing of the largest number of troops in the South since Reconstruction at Oxford, Mississippi, was designed simply to force social liberties on the people of the South. As civil rights demonstrations escalated between 1960 and 1963, many white Southerners sensed that both their way of life and their political esteem were on the defensive. How could the United States stand as a tower of strength before other nations? A female correspondent asked Vice President Johnson in 1963, if the government persisted in giving over to mass mob threats, quote unquote. A letter to President Kennedy warned about a dictatorial central government that has intellectual stooges to do its bidding. Sensing eventual defeat of the segregationist code, the writer of that letter prophesied that integration was the final product of the moral decay that would destroy the USA before communism took its toll. The troublemakers wanted to mix the schools, and when they got that, they were not satisfied. Then they sent in the South the Freedom Riders, which was like waving a red flag in a wild bull's face. I am sorry to say that our president have spent more trying to suppress the white people than he was trying to keep the Negroes home where they should be. An 87-year-old man named John S. Cole wrote from Fayetteville, North Carolina. The spring of 1963 brought a symbolic confrontation between federal marshals and Alabama Governor George C. Wallace over racial integration of a state university. Meanwhile, Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. led massive demonstrations and marches in Birmingham, where civil rights leaders struggled to force repeal of municipal segregation ordinances and win minority hiring in city employment. Although King continued to preach nonviolence, vicious police tactics, and continued white terrorism and vigilantism evoked furious nighttime rioting by enraged black youngsters. At the same time, King and other activists stepped up the campaign for a national civil rights bill to integrate public accommodations, enforce school desegregation, prohibit discrimination in employment, and guarantee voting rights. Among those who continued to see civil rights as a political pretext for expanding government power were small business entrepreneurs and independent professionals. The executive secretary of the Alabama Wholesale Grocers Association, who claimed to speak for the 5,000 food merchants in the state, one of its largest employers of colored labor, quote-unquote, protested to his congressman that President Kennedy had failed to adequately criticize instigators and rioters in Birmingham, and that such encouragement to extremists in the integration movement would, quote, only bring a harvest of ill will and maladjustment throughout this nation, unquote. In late May of 1963, the president of the National Federation of Independent Businesses warned Kennedy that economics lay at the roots of the civil rights crisis. Bayonets cannot achieve tolerance, C. Wilson Harder wrote to the president. In a more specific vein, an independent movie theater owner warned that the public accommodations clause in the proposed civil rights bill would wipe out thousands of southern theaters, depriving, quote, millions of working people of the only form of entertainment they can afford. Forced integration would bankrupt the southern movie houses, the writer predicted. White criticism of the civil rights movement only added to the insistence by movement leaders that the federal government play a greater role in assuring equal opportunity for blacks and other racial minorities. The Birmingham confrontations so dramatized the issues that 200,000 demonstrators rallied to the August 1963 March on Washington for jobs and racial integration. Following the assassination of President Kennedy in November 1963 and the accession of Lyndon Johnson to the presidency, Congress responded with the Civil Rights Act of 1964. The most controversial section of the bill gave the federal government the right to sue to desegregate public accommodations. For troubled whites, this seemed to suggest particular helplessness over the circumstances that affected daily life. In letters to the White House written before passage of the bill, working class and middle class whites, both inside and outside the South, poured out their frustrations to President Johnson. The Civil Rights Act was harsh legislation involving the morals, customs, and habits of our people, 24 signatories from Fairhope, Alabama, protested to the president. Do you want a federal Gestapo looking at every little independent businessman? Complained an Ohio letter. A telegram to the president put it succinctly. If you do not stand firm against that civil rights bill of Russian laws, you are no better than the traitor that planned it. Does a man's personal property rights, everyone's right of association, have to be sacrificed for the benefit of a minority? An Atlanta man asked the president. Civil rights legislation was particularly embittering to whites who perceived themselves outside the political and economic mainstream. No industry is being forced in placing my sons in jobs they would like to have, of Sinton, Texas, woman complained to the president. She was sick, sick, sick of hearing of the sorrowful plight of Black Americans. Race relations obviously was an emotional issue in which rational logic did not always apply. But those who objected to government-sponsored advances in this area of social relations did comprehend that their own problems and circumstances were not receiving equal attention from the federal government or the media. For many Americans struggling for economic survival, the federal government's attention to Black civil rights was another reminder of their own unimportance in the scheme of things. During the debate over the Civil Rights Act of 1964, President Johnson received a petition with more than 500 signatures from Roosevelt Local Number 265 of the United Papermakers and Paperworkers of Pritchard, Alabama. "The Civil Rights Bill," their protest read, "will take away our constitutional rights." The social implications of federally sponsored civil rights legislation had been brilliantly analyzed by Johnson aide George Reedy during 1963. Reedy astutely summarized white resistance to racial integration of public accommodation schools and jobs. "White opponents believe that the central issue was enforced association," Reedy wrote, "the right to marry somebody's daughter, the right to enter someone's home as an uninvited guest, the right to inflict an unwelcome presence upon people engaging in social activities." And that was Reedy. Although Blacks saw integrated public accommodations as simply providing the freedom to move around the country without inconvenience, whites viewed this as providing license for Blacks to eat in gourmet restaurants, to sleep in elaborate hotels, and to enjoy the social prestige of using the same toilet facilities as whites. For Blacks, integration meant access to the public institutions essential to survival in a competitive economy. To whites, however, integration meant, quote, "enforced association on the way to miscegenation," unquote. In employment matters, Blacks desired the right to compete for jobs and not be denied the opportunity to accomplish what their qualifications permitted them to do. For whites, equal opportunity in employment meant the threat of Blacks taking away jobs. A Long Beach, California correspondent to the White House reflected on the disruptive nature of the civil rights demonstrations. "Mr. President," she wrote, "our country looks more like a foreign one every day. I see and hear nothing but marching by Negroes, communists, and labor. Why don't you bring this shameless nonsense to a halt?" And a North Carolina woman warned, "If we try to solve all our problems in the streets, we shall become a nation in riot." And this has been A Nation in Riot by David Horowitz from his book, Beyond Left and Right. This is Michael McCusker. Linda Brown, who was denied admission to her local elementary school in Topeka, Kansas, and was the specific subject of Brown versus Board of Education, died March 25th, 2018, at age 76.